Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Lauren Wolf, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the poet Scott Silsby. Scott Silsby was born in Detroit and now lives in Pittsburgh, where he sells books, makes music with friends, and writes. His poems have recently appeared in Nerf Cowboy, Words Dance, The Cultural Weekly, and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Six Gallery Press published his book, Unattended Fire, in 2012, and Low Ghost published The River Underneath the City in 2013. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great. Could you begin by reading us some poems?
Sure, I'd be happy to. This one's called Late Monday. Sometimes we speak in dreams, and the mind has a dream of its own. The long shadows of drinks on tables, or a small shadow in the shape of a body. There are those who leave but will never return. A sign flashes over the bus station, and it says, History. Thinking yesterday about circles, it goes like this. Something is new and therefore strange, and then old and boring. There are some sounds only strangers can make. I'm just getting a bit nostalgic, she said, and I felt bad. She was saying that she felt a pain at returning home before she had even left. It's funny what a city can do to a body, thinking in twos, to leave and to return. Neurons firing like that. Desire. Somehow it became evening. There was a book on the table, and it was called The Attentive Brain. Nearby, they were destroying the local hospital, and someone in the next house over was singing, I would do anything. I would do anything. The radio said there was a crisis somewhere, and I realized that I couldn't say anything because I had already said everything that I could possibly say to you at least once, which got me thinking about desire. Do we always want what we can't have? I remember asking my friend once. No, he said to me. I can't have a helicopter, but I don't want one. All right, this one's called Hikmet. Tonight, I am thinking of Hikmet, over 40 years old, a poet in prison for writing poems, measuring the paces of his cell. And here I sit trying to write a good poem. It could be that good poems are only written out of darkness and despair. But Hikmet said, living is no laughing matter, and live with great seriousness, and live as if you will never die. I don't need an Ars Poetica to say that I write to remember, remind myself of the little things that happened here and there. Sometimes I curse myself for not writing more, but then I tell myself that I am just working on material by living. My copy of Hikmet has burnt fly leaves and page edges, which leads me to believe it was rescued from a fire. Some of Hikmet's poems traveled from a prison in Turkey, through fire, to multiple bookstores, no doubt, to my desk. Last night. We were drinking devil wine on a Tuesday night. It was me and Bob and Paulette, and we were drinking the devil wine in the attic. A woman at the grocery store had made Paulette blow into a breathalyzer. She passed the test, we bought the wine, we brought it home, and then Bob stopped by. We went to the attic, and I put on one of Paulette's Dead Kennedys cassettes, and when it started, she said to us, "This is the best Dead Kennedys song." And Bob said to me, "So you're calling off tomorrow?" And I said, "I'm taking the day off." And he said, "Cheers." And he clinked his wine glass with my water glass because I had run out of devil wine in my wine glass. Outside, a strong wind started to rattle at our windows. I think Paulette said something about tornado weather. And the conversation took a left turn, but then a right. And before we knew it, the bottle of devil wine was empty. All right, here's a short one. Randy, this is terrific. I walked down to the corner store for a half case, and the guy behind the counter gives me an extra can for the walk home. So I give him a dollar tip, and he yells, "Powerball," as I'm walking out the door.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Scott Silsby. So, Scott, what I sort of find resonating in your work is sort of this meditative quality. Are you conscious of that?
I'm conscious of it. I guess for me, I'm always looking at the world around me, and I'm inspired by that world around me. And so I carry a little notepad, and I'm always kind of jotting notes down from things I see or things I hear. And but there's that moment, and then there's the moment later where I kind of revisit the note, and the poem comes out of that. Mm-hmm. And so I think the meditation kind of is that second part, you know, making sense of the chaos of the notepad.
Right. So what kind of things do you find that you're attracted to writing down?
A lot of times it's things that people say, that I hear people say. I'm really interested in language and how we choose to express ourselves. You know, there's a unique way that kind of the people around me, my coworkers and friends express themselves. There's a unique way in which Pittsburghers in general express themselves. So a lot of times it's language, how people talk, but it's also just kind of in general, the world around me, I guess.
Right, because in your poems there's a very strong sense of imagery, especially like concrete, tangible things.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's intentional.
Do those things end up in the notebook, or do you just sort of add those later?
Yeah, those things end up in the notebook, but I think that it's an intentional thing. Just I like concrete objects. I like things, and I think that really kind of grounds the poem. It really kind of grabs the reader more when you're dealing with those kind of things. Things that people can relate to, you know.
Right. I definitely felt grounded, like set up in a place, and here we are in this place that's slightly dreamy in a sense. And I like that. So do you feel like as you're moving through the world, you're very observant and you pick those things up and then put them in poems?
Yeah. I mean, not all the time, but I think there is this kind of bug in me. It's just the like artist bug or writer bug that, you know, sometimes life just like jumps out at you and you notice, you hear something or you see something that, you know, you pick up on. And it's usually something that's kind of weird to me. And I think that, it's just that moment where life jumps out.
How do you use those moments then to build up into a poem?
Yeah, that's the thing that is a little bit kind of hard for me to articulate, because I don't know exactly where it all comes together. It's just it's kind of collage-y for me.
Okay.
But I try to. It's just kind of an ordering or a structuring, trying to make order out of the chaos of the scattered notes.
Well, I tend to write in sort of the same way, gathering, and then putting something together. So, you know, everybody's process is a little bit different.
Right.
I also really like this play. There's this juxtaposition of sort of humor and seriousness in your pieces.
Yeah.
Do you go into a poem with that sort of intention? Are you trying to pace the reader in a different way?
I think that it's something that I've kind of developed from reading writers that do that, like Frank O'Hara or like a Richard Hugo. I think it's just something that it's kind of like I've picked it up just from reading other people, and it's something that I know, like the humor element is something I know I really appreciate in writing, and so.
I think that's interesting because. Do you find when you're reading a certain poet for a consistent basis or just, you know, you pick up a book, start reading it, and then your poems come out sort of in that style? Does that happen?
I think it is kind of like osmosis or something where it's just you suck it in. Mm-hmm. You know? I'm kind of spongy like that.
Right. And then you close the book and then all of a sudden you're writing lines. Lines are coming through your head that are sort of in the style of what you just read, and it's weird.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I feel that way. And I mean, I think one of the things for me is to try and read a lot. So read a lot of different people and read a lot quantity wise so that it's not just one thing unadulterated right. that I'm copying. You know,
right.
it's kind of, I can kind of create a style by putting a little Frankenstein of different writers together with my own voice.
That's great because your poems don't sound Frankensteinian at all. So that's nice. It's nice to know that, you do it in sort of pieces. Can you read us some more poems?
Sure, I'd be happy to. All right, this one's called Temp. The summer that I graduated from college with a degree in not much, a degree my father had warned me would not get me work anywhere, I took a job temping at a box factory. It was just to pay the bills until I moved to Pittsburgh. It was your typical assembly line kind of work. There were quotas, but they weren't unreasonable, and there were other young temps on the line with me. The factory smelled of cardboard every day, and there were machines that would drizzle glue onto boxes, and then we had to stick these little cardboard cubes onto the box glue. One day I saw a kid who had to be younger than me, maybe 21 or 22, get his hands too close to these two spinning rollers that were flying, going I don't know how many miles per hour, and one of the rollers sucked his hands right in between the two till they were wedged there, and blood from his hands trickled below where glue was supposed to. The kid, whose name I forget now, screamed like I have never heard a grown man scream. Some of us thought he was just joking around until we saw the blood. It took three people to turn the machine off. Some 10 minutes later, we line workers were out behind the factory in what could have been a courtyard, but was really just a gravel lot. Some of us talked about it, trying to figure out how it had happened. Most of us stared at the ground. A couple people smoked cigarettes. After a little longer, the line supervisor told us to get back in there and get back to work. I decided against that, punched my time card, and quit boxes, opting to weld office chair legs that summer instead. One night at the Plaza Lounge. I had read poems, and Dave had read prose, at this little corner cafe in Regent Square. Then we drank beers at a small house bar that used to be Donnie's, but was renamed Howard's, until they kicked us out at 11, claiming their neighbors were an issue. Our waitress, who seemed drunk herself, was sweet to us and apologetic, but was insistent that we had to go, even though we had only had a few and wanted more. So we drove to the Plaza in Forest Hills, which was in the wrong direction of home for me, but which was blocks from Bob's and just about halfway home for Dave. The Plaza was a dive in an old strip mall, wedged between a Subway sandwich shop and a hair salon. It reeked of old cigarettes, and there was bad music going on the juke. Still, it was better than the bar up the street, where they threw around racial slurs openly, assuming that everyone else felt the same. Bob hated them for it and got back at them any way he could, though it seemed probably the best idea was just to not go there anymore. We ignored the jukebox music at the Plaza, got revenge on it by talking about good music. Dave asked me if I knew of Peter Lochner, and I said no, but I asked Dave if he'd ever heard of the Mountain Goats and their song The Best Ever Death Metal Band in Denton from their great album All Hail West Texas. And Dave said, do you listen to Waylon? And I said, some. I've been playing some early Haggard lately. Do you like him? And Dave said, I don't like his politics. I thought about saying something about separating the artist from the art, but didn't. Bob and Dave talked about some festival they went to featuring old hair metal bands, about how they got drinky at some crappy chain restaurant on the way to the festival, and Bob drank all of Dave's wine coolers on the rest of the drive. There was a funny part of the story where some drunken girl started grinding on the hood of Dave's car, and Bob said to him, Do you know her? Dave was drinking bottles of Coors Light. Bob and I were drinking Yuengling Drafts. After enough of them, the plaza seemed like a good bar. It almost felt like some kind of interplanetary spaceship to me, tilting its way through a vast unknown, a marvel of space and time. The smoke hung in a lazy gray oval over our heads. I made the assessment that Bob, Dave, and I were the only ones not smoking, which included the woman serving us. We were taking in plenty just the same. We knew that all of the world was dying. We knew that our ship was going down in flames. It felt like a good way to go. Looking for alcohol. We come in out of the cold and the light of the street. Why? We are looking for alcohol. We've worked our jobs to pay our bills, and now we need a drink. This place has good beers on tap, and they seem to like how we can put them away. They ask us if we want another before we finish these we're drinking. Even when I'm making my way through the library to get the book of poems by Gerald Loughlin they've got stashed away behind the counter with my name on it, and I discover you at a table reading an old issue of Rolling Stone, one of the first things you say to me when I sit down across from you after saying, "Ha!" is, "Are you ready for a drink?" And I say I am, and we go out looking for alcohol. We snake through to the back rooms of bookshops, Bob for beers and art gallery bathtubs, suffer through all sorts of art that, let's be honest, only a mother could love. Why? Because we're looking for alcohol. Maybe we should be ashamed of ourselves. Maybe, but we're not. This is who we are, and we can both be comfortable with that. We are thirsty individuals, and we realize there are consequences for our thirst. Perhaps that just makes it better. I'm not apologizing. Who doesn't love a little destruction? Let's keep on it.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Scott Silsby. So, Scott, in one of your previous poems that you read earlier, in the Hikmet poem, you said, the speaker says, "I write to remember."
Yes.
Is that something that you feel you do as a poet?
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty much me speaking in that poem. And yeah, kind of like what I was talking about earlier with kind of taking notes in my notepad. It is something that I try to do. I try to write things that happen to me or around me as almost a kind of way of journaling. Which I think probably one reason people journal is not only to remember, but to it kind of makes their life better to kind of have these really strong, detailed memories. And for me, it's poetry, something that it just makes my life better because I'm able to remember things that I otherwise probably mm-hmm. would have lost.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting approach. I'm not always conscious of doing that when I'm writing, is, you know, to form a memory, let's say. In those poems that you just read, those sort of more narrative poems,
yeah.
a little less meditative.
Yeah.
What do you think's at stake in those poems?
What do I think is at stake?
What should the reader gather from a piece like that? What's sort of the overall universal message, let's say?
I'm not really sure. I guess it's just a kind of like a humanness, you know, a human documentation. This is like where we were at a certain point in time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't know.
Well, for me as a reader or a listener,
yeah,
I felt that some things were at stake were sort of this friendship, you know,
yeah.
friendship and the factory life, like what that's like for somebody that has a college degree, you know, that's heavy stuff. Kind of, even though you didn't approach it in a really heavy manner, but I like that poem.
Kind of like a general human camaraderie or
right.
We're in this together.
How we focus a poem just on a moment.
Right.
But then still make it something that people can relate to, I guess.
Yeah.
And I really like that.
It becomes larger outside of that moment somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's at least what we hope, right?
We hope, yes.
So when you're crafting sort of those narrative poems or any of your other pieces, how do you know when the poem is finished? You have these really smooth endings like, oh, the world was dying. It was a good way to go.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I guess the endings are always tricky.
Yeah.
And I don't always know when I hit it, but it's just something that I guess comes to you when you work on a poem after long enough.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's just something that eventually I get to the point where I reach a kind of conclusion in my head, and I can't even necessarily articulate what that conclusion is, you know, but I feel like the poem has made its statement.
Right.
You know? And so it's just kind of a natural process that a poem works through, you know.
Is your revision process really intense?
Revision
process? Do you do most of the work in revision or
no, I don't think it's very intense. I think I typically build the revision process into the writing. And so
lucky you.
Yeah, I mean maybe I'm just lazy, but
No. I think that takes skill and talent to build it into the process.
But it's just like, I mean, every line it feels like I tinker with it as I'm writing it, and I go back and, like, you know, as when I'm still working on the poem, I kind of go back and tinker along the way.
Cool. I think that approach always fascinates me because I find that difficult. Could you read some more poems?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Some Faint Music. The darker clouds are starting to move this way, but there are still some patches of blue and a bit of sun occasionally. Birds are making their calls, some very close by and some a few blocks away. Still a little hungover from too many Derby Day mint juleps had while watching the horses run on a small television in a row house in Bloomfield, then more juleps later at a bar with Bob and Amy for Bob's birthday. Bob kept ordering us rounds of them, and Amy kept complaining about how terrible the waitress was at her job. But now I'm out on my back deck with Levine and Vonnegut, and it seems like it wants to rain, though it's just warm enough for short sleeves. There's one shot of Puerto Rican espresso in my coffee, and planes are buzzing over my head. And inside the house, I hear some faint music playing in the kitchen, Paulette singing or whistling along with it. I think it's Billie Holiday, though it might be Roy Brown. Pinball, 1983. Marv's bar was a basement with a television, a pool table, four stools, and a Star Trek pinball machine. I was 5 years old, but my sister was 9, so she would get pictures of Bud Light, fresh from the tap, sneaking off a sip, mostly of foam, on her way to delivering the pitcher to Marv, while I flipped the flippers, sending the flashing silver ball past Uhura with Kirk and Spock looking on from the big, bright Bally scoreboard. The toys were endless. Atari, plastic pin bowling, electric racer cars. And when you were old enough, Marv taught you how to play pool, warning you not to miss the cue ball, explaining how expensive it was to pay for the soft green surface. And when you were older, you could go behind the bar to find the dirty joke books you couldn't understand. Most of the regulars at Marv's bar are nowhere to be found anymore. Dottie, Chuck, Marv. And I was just a kid, so I don't even know who all of the regulars were. Those are the ones who mattered to me, though. I can still hear traces of those days in my head. Dottie slamming down a card on the kitchen table and screaming with delight. Chuck's laugh that was a funny, high-pitched giggle trickling down into a hearty cackle. And I can hear Marv making his way from his bar to his workshop, singing, Hey, mister, you better hide your sister, because the fleet's in. Old writers talking about old writers. Bob and I were at the cage after a Hemingway's reading, and I was telling him about how I wanted to make a book or a CD or something called that. We'd just seen Ochester, and after the reading, Ed treated us with some great stories about Harry Cruz, stories you could tell he had told over and over again to get the pacing right and to suck us all in and to know the right way to punchline. Maybe the book, or whatever it is, could be called Younger Writers Telling Stories About Old Writers Talking About Old Writers. I could ask Bob and Dave and Lori and Chris to tell some. And I could tell about Gerald Stern talking about Gilbert jumping over the cathedral hedges on Forbes Avenue, or recount Chuck Kinder's tale about Richard Hugo and his big bowl of vanilla ice cream. It'd be nice to get some down so we don't lose them. Stories grow soft with time, though sometimes we fill in the gaps with juicier details to make the story better, making the story our own, with the hope we don't lose the best parts, we don't sacrifice the real story, as if we really know or care what that is. Girl with Dog in the Time to Wash Parking Lot, Wilkinsburg, PA. Which of us can say what exactly it was that made it such a stunning image? But both of us caught it, the timing perfect, as we drove down South Avenue after a long day of loading books and records, CDs and DVDs, into a 24-foot truck at an old house out in the North Hills of Pittsburgh. Was it the long hours we had worked on a Sunday, or was it the light of the day over the laundromat? Or the unbridled joy of both girl and dog dancing in their small circle in the busted gravel of the lot, leaving their feet and returning to the ground again. It was no doubt all of those things, and perhaps something else, something like the word duende, an inarticulatable feeling, like the birth of a song.
The poetry of Scott Silsby. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment newsweekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 FM.